Welcome back to the Spiritual Bazaar. This is A, and this is part two of my interview with Ted Peters, where we discuss spirituality, of course, but religion, mysticism, UFO encounters, and so much more.
I'll just pause for a minute, Alpha, and think. You're walking into this absolutely amazing situation, and you're going to ask a question that arises from your scientific and your technological curiosity. I understand that. That's the kind of family I grew up in. And I probably asked that same question too, but note how culturally specific this is. He wouldn't have asked that question 400 years ago. So how does it fly? Well, the spaceling who had ushered him in opens up a panel in which he sees field winding. So if you were inside an electrical motor, you would see all these wires like spaghetti, you know, wound around. And you'd be within a magnetic field. And so he says, oh, well, then that makes the floor of the flying saucer the armature, right? And the spaceling nods, yes, you're right. So we've satisfied his scientific question right off the bat. I think that's so important because it's not just Mr. Jackson we're talking about. We're talking about the whole culture. That is coming to articulation in Mr. Jackson's psyche here. He engages the two in conversation. They speak perfect English. He stressed that they speak perfect English. Why is it perfect? Well, it's perfect because there's no umming and aying and well. It's perfect because every word is pronounced correctly. The grammar is flawless. So why in the world would Mr. Jackson even care that the language is perfect? Well, Carl Jung would answer quickly, of course it's got to be perfect because they come from a perfected society. And of course, that's exactly what gets confirmed as Mr. Jackson engages in conversation with the man appointed to speak with him, that their society on what's called Planta, P-L-A-N-T-E-H, their society is more highly evolved than ours. And it's so important because in our culture, we believe evolution, like progress, leads us towards perfection. So, yes, they come from a perfected society that's more highly evolved, and now they're coming back, not just in space, but in time, to help us Earthlings to progress towards their level of perfection. And all of this takes place in the conversation that Mr. Jackson has with the UFOnaut. And I just want to stress, as Carl Jung stressed, how important this symbolism of perfection is, the roundness of the craft, its inner glow. Mr. Jackson reported that as he walked through the doorway, he felt sanitized. You know, well, that's a ritual of purification that our ancient ancestors felt when they got baptized or they entered a shrine or something like that. Then the spaceling asked Mr. Jackson to recruit Earthlings to go to an experimental planet that they were preparing, in which everybody would have all of their needs met, all the food they could eat, this, that, and the next thing. Life would be perfect. There'd be no war, no violence, no disease. People would live in perpetuity. And all of this, and Mr. Jackson says, I'm sorry, I can't do this. Well, why not? Well, I'm going to die. Well, what are you going to die of? Well, and he listed to me, I asked him, what are you going to die of? He's got a couple diseases. So it's easy to guess what the spaceman says next, namely, Well, if you do this for us, we'll cure your diseases. So we've got, you know, now advanced medical science. And you had raised earlier, Alpha, this question about a need. And there's no question that Mr. Jackson, who had received this medical diagnosis and now was recognizing that his days were numbered, has a deep, profound need. And what the people from outer space are offering is good health and everlasting life. So I said to Mr. Jackson, have you ever heard of this place before, this planet? Well, yes. Well, what do you call it? He says, I call it heaven. I said, yeah, that's right. They're going to give you, through technology, heaven. Yep, that's what they're going to... Well, at any rate, so Mr. Jackson finally bids adieu, and he goes back to bed. And the spaceship flies off. Now, I don't know about you, Alpha, but if I had an experience like that, I doubt if I'd be going back to bed right afterward. So what I want to look at is not the objective. Did it happen? What I want to look at is, what is the meaning for Mr. Jackson himself and for our wider culture? And I think
what is that?
Something to do with technology can give us what the outdated religions seem unable to give us.
A message of salvation through science rather than religion.
That's right.
Okay. You know, when you say you wouldn't go to bed after something like that, maybe he actually could go to bed because he felt at ease. Like, oh, okay,
that's a good point.
I have nothing to worry about. Life is, everything's going to work out.
You know, that's actually, I hadn't thought about that. But yes, his anxiety was so relieved. Now he could sleep soundly. What he didn't say is maybe he was tossing and turning before the event happened, and then he could sleep like a baby. I hadn't thought about that, but you might be right. Yeah.
Yeah, and for me that does sort of sound like a sort of a process of self healing. You know, I mean, in the 12-step program that I use, you have someone, Bill W, who founded AA some time ago. We talk about his experience, and you know, he, like some others, said, you know, they had this moment where there was just this light, this clarity. It came to them. Their anxiety, right, their depression just sort of melted away, and they can start working on, from that point, they can start working on themselves because they didn't have that desperate need for filling in that hole, whatever that hole was. And I wonder if that's just his version of that. You know, but then you do have other encounters that I think lean more towards our idea of a religious experience in the terms of either Christianity or some other religion, right? I mean, it's not all through the means of science.
Oh, yes. There are some instances in which the Christian symbolism is just front and center. Yeah, they're not all oblique. As it was in the Dick Jackson case. I'd even asked Dick Jackson, well, you know, how are you with religion? Oh, I don't believe in God and stuff like that. So Mr. Jackson was a non-believer, but it is the case that there are others who actually see Jesus in their UFO experiences. Not a lot, but a number of them. So what I think is happening there is that we bring to all experiences, including mystical experiences, a set of symbols through which we interpret them so that they become meaningful. And in Mr. Jackson's case, there would be no religious symbols in his mind, but science and technology and medicine, yep, those were the ones that were alive for him. Now, I don't want to reduce those who claim to see Jesus, you know, to only projecting their own worldview on their experience. I don't want to do that. I just want to say that those symbols are there before the experience occurs, and so it's not surprising that the shocking experience gets interpreted in Christian terms.
Ted, I want to ask you, what is the Axis Mundi?
Axis Mundi in Latin is literally the axle that marks the center of the earth. And I think it's a handy idea for identifying religious groups, especially in ancient societies where societies were smaller. They geographically constructed their villages or campgrounds or what have you with a center. And that center frequently had a pole of one kind or another, or a tower that connected heaven and earth, and that's where the most sacred thing is located, and you would build your house, so to speak, in orientation towards it. And if you had a town meeting and the king or the chief would give a speech, he would stand there at the Axis Mundi so that everyone would get a sense that it was sacred in character. And churches with really tall steeples have a tendency to reiterate that, and small villages in pre-modern Europe, if you look at them carefully, they have a town square, which is the center. There's a church with a tall steeple, there's the city hall, and maybe a school, and then in the square is where the farmers bring their vegetables and stuff. And so the towns are built around an Axis Mundi, and that goes all the way back to biblical times when the book of Revelation has the city four square. So they were already doing that then. So the Axis Mundi is the center, and it could be a psychological center as well as a geographical center. So let me ask you how you bring that up, and what's on your mind?
Well, you do mention something about Washington, D.C. being the modern Axis Mundi.
Yes. I think for the globe, if you just drop the word White House or Washington, people sort of tacitly assume, hey, that's the center of global power. Power and sacredness usually go together, etc. And I like to warn people who have faith in God to watch out for pseudo-Axis Mundis running around. And Washington, getting back to where we were earlier about soccer, that Washington can easily become a spiritual center for us when, in fact, it's only a political or to a lesser extent, cultural center. It's only a political center. It's not eternal at all, despite the fact that Abraham Lincoln says this nation will never perish from the earth. I'm afraid it probably will, just like every other nation.
Yeah, but the political party system too kind of begs you to worship, them as the sort of Axis Mundi, or perhaps the heart of the Axis Mundi, if you can even say that, in Washington, D.C. But the United States, sort of in terms of what we're talking about here, I feel like sort of launched the platform for the discussion of the UFO phenomena and these experiences that people have. And so in a way, I can kind of see as, in terms of what you're writing about, Washington, D.C. is the Axis Mundi of this conversation. Because it's from the United States that books started getting published, words started getting out. Now you have documentaries galore discussing this issue. And all the meanwhile, I think you're right, there's been this leaving out of the spiritual aspect of it. It's become just so secular and nuts and bolts, and I really just don't hear, your perspective very often from anyone else.
Well, let's talk about that Washington thing. there's an aspect of the UFO phenomenon which is widely overlooked, and it makes Washington into the Axis Mundi, but in a reverse kind of way, and that is that in the American UFO experience, Washington is accused of suppressing the truth about the interstellar nature of UFOs. And it begins already in the very first book of the UFO genre, 1950, that the very first books already are accusing Washington of hiding the truth. Even if you go back to Roswell in July of 1947, what happens? Well, the Army Air Force pretends that the Roswell crash was actually a balloon, etc. So right from the beginning now, the UFO phenomenon is making people angry that Washington is hiding the truth. Now, you run that all the way down history. We're talking, 60 years now, down to the present date, and we have this disclosure movement amongst UFO people to get the truth from Washington. Well, I want to say, I want to ask, what's going on here? It's the Axis Mundi at work. So those who believe that Washington is conspiring to hold the truth also believe that an extraterrestrial civilization has contacted the White House and they've made a deal. And this deal helps to ensure that America will stay on top in science and technology. Mm-hmm. You already know about these claims that lasers got a jump, because of the technology discovered as well.
Yeah, that came from Colonel Philip Corso, I think.
Philip Corso is the guy who did that. But, and so you get testimonies from former officials in the intelligence or the military who are talking about where these secrets are hid and all of that kind of thing. What's going on there? Here's my theory, and I want to know, Alpha, if you think this is credible or not. The Axis Mundi not only locates the sacred, but it also locates the source of power. So if you and I want to believe that Washington has a connection with extraterrestrials, which is the sky, it connects heaven and earth, a connection with extraterrestrials who have more power than any nation on earth, and if the extraterrestrials have blessed the United States with an alliance between the White House and extraterrestrial civilization, that means our nation's capital and our nation has heavenly power in the form of science and technology, heavenly power that we are blessed with. So the so-called anger against Washington over the conspiracy is actually a form of laud and worship.
Yeah,
very
interesting.
Washington is the Axis Mundi that connects heaven and earth. So that's Ted's theory. Now, do you think I'm crazy?
No, I think the psychology there makes absolute sense. Because in our desire to believe in something higher, that was not meant to be a rhyme, but there you are.
Desire for higher.
we can project any kind of theory onto anything to justify why we are missing something in our lives, and I think you're right in a way. Even though there's anger at this so-called conspiracy, there's a worship in it as well. There's a sort of hope through the conspiracy. Yeah.
Right.
And it brings us back to the sort of mystical experience, because holding on to a mystery is a sort of I hate to use this word again, but it is a sort of spiritual experience, because living in a mystery is a sort of an ethereal sense, a feeling that there's something else there. And I think that's sort of part of what makes us human beings, because I feel like if there's no mystery, we're left with not very much. Even science, it doesn't matter how much you prove the next new thing, there's always so much more to learn. You know, there's so many other things that are hidden, and that mystery, I feel like if you can embrace the mystery and not be angry at it, you know, I think that you can find yourself in a healthier state of mind.
Well, how in your own personal experience with mystery in general, or perhaps a mystical connection with that which transcends you, how does that actually inform what you just said? Namely, we're going to be healthier if we live with the mystery.
For instance, you have people who are zealous about their religion, because I think that they strongly hold on to whatever dogma they were told to that is the truth to be. They hold on to it so tight that they are unable to have more empathy or compassion for other people, because their way is the only right way, and this obviously leads to conflict and war and so forth. I think that the religious people who say, I have a faith, I believe in something, but I can't prove it, and that's okay, I'm okay with that, I think those people are much more at peace with their own belief. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense to me. What you're describing there is what I call in the book, Sin Boldly, I call a fragile soul. A fragile soul wants to be right. And what happens is the dogma functions kind of like the Axis Mundi, like the Washington we were talking about. Mm-hmm. The dogma becomes the connection between heaven and earth, and that's why a fragile soul is so tenacious in not wanting to let that dogma get relativized. But obviously, we're a little bit healthier when we can recognize that the true God is going to be mysterious. There's going to be as we used to say in seminary, you can't grab God by the ass. God won't allow it. Or St. Paul says it much more eloquently, how unsearchable and incomprehensible are the riches of God. So no dogma actually does connect heaven with earth, because the higher it gets, the more it fades off into an incomprehensible mystery, and we're going to be a lot less fragile. This is, you said, we're less likely to go to war. We're going to be a lot less fragile if we accept that incalculable mystery that belongs to our relationship with God. If we can rest in that mystery, boy, we're going to be a lot less violent.
Yeah, it's interesting you brought up that, about fragility. And even in a different context, coming from a place of having issues with addiction, a lot of, addicts, like I said, have that sort of hole that something's not right, something's missing, and they need to fill it. And I think that is a fragility in its own right too. I think, you feel like there's, the floor has been swept underneath you, and what do you do? I only know one thing to do to make myself feel better.
Right.
No.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, and to get more to the point of what you were asking me, I feel my interpretation of a higher power is, what I call like the super consciousness of the universe. I call it the universe with a capital U. I feel that there's something going on. I feel like there is a sort of life force breathing in and out, and we're part of this process of evolution and creation and so forth. But I just don't feel comfortable you know, making claim to know, first of all, what any of that is. And because of that, I have a hard time subscribing to any one particular religion.
I understand that. Let me just say the position I hear you enunciating sounds to me a lot like what I would call evolutionary naturalism, and there are a number of very astute proponents of that. Biologist Ursula Goodenough would be an example, or computer whiz Stuart Kaufman of the Santa Fe Institute would resonate very much with what you're saying, and you capitalize the U on universe. They would so it's a naturalism that still has the equivalent of a spiritual entelechy that is guiding us into increased complexity, and the cosmos becomes self-conscious through our own consciousness. Let me just say that's a position I respect, and if I were to sustain that position, I'd say, well, the problem with the traditional religions is they were born in history and they reflect their own cultural context, which is now out of date since we've developed the modern sciences. And certainly this view is much more compatible with evolution and cosmology and things like that. But then I would want to turn around and say, oh, but evolution and cosmology are also historically specific to the modern West. And oh, yes, you and I are swimming in these waters these days. Mm-hmm. But, you know, a century or two from now, that's going to be history as well. And so I think however we approach the ultimate mystery, whether through a traditional religion or in light of a contemporary view of nature through science, however we approach that mystery, it's going to be conditioned on our time and place and our language and culture and things like that. So I tend to respect that period I was mentioning 2.5 millennia ago, when there was sort of a breakthrough to transcendence. And then I live my life every day through the Christian symbol system, but I certainly don't want to say the symbol system is absolute and everybody else's is wrong. I certainly learned that, you know, again, the dogmas are not Axis Mundi, even if I may feel like it, they're not. So, anyway, that's things, so.
Yeah, and whatever you know, one thinks about the context of when the religion or belief is born. You know, obviously religion has evolved a little bit with time, you know, with culture and society, especially in, you know, the last 50 years, to be sure. And science, like you said, when it was sort of born out or reborn again, you know, deism and the idea that, you know, that God exists and science coexist, that was, you know, a thought for a couple hundred years. I mean, that was the scientific way of thinking. And then you fast forward a little bit and you still have someone like Einstein who you can debate back and forth whether he believed in a, you know, big G-O-D or not. But in terms of how he spoke about his love of science, and he spoke about it in a spiritual way. And he was very tricky with how he minced his words, because you couldn't really nail him down, you know, just by reading some of the things that he said. But he did have this sense of this unbelievable, incomprehensible greatness. And there was something sort of beautiful and spiritual in that. And a lot of scientists still have that to this day, I think. So whether they can just say, I believe in a God or not, there is a sort of a sense of a religious experience through the mystery of it.
I resonate with your description of Einstein and with science in its ideal state. And you and I probably both know scientists for whom wonder and curiosity are what really drives them. I really do. And getting back to our earlier conversation about the needs of the inner soul, I think there are some among us, not every individual, but there are some among us whose inner drive, curiosity and wonder comes to expression in scientific research and discovery. And I think that is a wonderful blessing that we experience in the human spirit. I hate to say this, but even though I'm a theologian, I read more science than I do theology. My Nature magazine and Science magazine comes in. Boy, I drop everything to read them. Why? Well, I think my spirit is attuned, and every time there's a great discovery, I do an intellectual form of cartwheel and applause, etc. So I really do understand that, and I think that's a divine gift to the human soul that some of us in our society have that, and it's authentic. Let me tell you a story about a physicist, a Hindu physicist. And it was one-on-one. I'm asking him, you know, about this, that, and the next thing. And he starts talking about God. And after about the fourth or fifth reference to God, I said, excuse me, I need to ask you a question. Do you believe God is personal or impersonal? As you're probably aware, within Hinduism, you can affirm Nirguna Brahman, that's the divine that's beyond personhood, or Saguna Brahman, which is the universal reality with personal attributes, because in the Hindu scheme, the negative Brahman without attributes is slightly higher than Brahman with attributes. So, I said this question to him. He says, "Oh, I believe God is personal." I said, "Well, why?" He says, "Well, as you know, I'm a physicist. And when I look at those galaxies 11 billion light years distant, and I know what the laws are by which those galaxies are governed, and I know that they all came from a single Big Bang and that they are expanding, I just want to say thank you to God for making my mind able to comprehend the divine reality." And I thought, oh, okay, here's a guy who has leaped from his experience, as you were describing Einstein, leap from that to the point of saying, I want to say thank you to somebody that science is possible. So anyway, now that's my story. And it is an amazing thing. And I think Einstein actually said this, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is it's comprehensible. And so how did that happen? Well, this guy wants to thank personal God for that.
Mm. Have you ever had of your own experience a revelatory experience?
No, I am not blessed with a mystical experience at all, but I certainly have, as I mentioned earlier, interviewed in depth those people who claim to, and I'm willing to take their word for it. Would I like one? I've often thought I would love to have a flying saucer just fall in my backyard, and I'd like to talk with people inside, and I'm going to ask Dick Jackson's question, how does it fly?
Well, if it did happen, would you ask them, are you a messenger from God? Or do you think you'd just be so in awe?
That'd be the second question right after how does it fly, but yes, of course I would ask them that, yeah.
All right, and cool.
I can't predict the answer either. I'd be interested in what they're going to say.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You talk about personal God. I was just talking to someone recently, and we're having this conversation now. I'm gonna pray for someone. So, and I just I have always had that reoccurring thought, as I was originally a Catholic and no longer am, and I always had that thought of, and it, so have millions and millions of other people, the same thought. Well, if I pray for something or someone's health and they die, or if I pray for someone or something and they live, either way, it's God's plan. So, you know, I kind of wondered, and this is because of my own personal experience, and other people share a similar experience, is when I open myself up to that sort of, you know, unspoken energy, whatever, unknown energy, things in my own life can start unfolding. I wonder, you know, if with prayer, I can pray for myself and ask, all right, please lay a path before me, help me out, blah, blah, blah. And if I believe enough, I feel like it can work. But I don't know if I believe that if I pray for someone else, that it's going to be effective at all, only because I feel like they have a personal relationship with their higher power. They have their own life path. So I don't know if praying for them really is effective at all.
I think that is a common question, certainly one I ask. I once was putting together a book of essays, and I came to the topic, should we pray for rain? And I asked a charismatic, and I asked a Roman Catholic Jesuit to give me an essay. The Jesuit says that praying for rain has no effect on the weather. It just opens us to accept whatever God's will is. The charismatic said, well, of course it will have an effect on God. God will decide whether to send rain or not, but of course you would expect God to consider and answer your prayer. And so you get these two different logics. I have to say that a little confused about this. If you take a look at what happens in our nation, mm-hmm. Not the church, but a nation, when does our nation pray? Well, obviously, right after a tragedy. You know, if you have a massacre of innocent people, or just take the Dallas case where five policemen were ambushed and died. Suddenly, the whole nation is at prayer in the churches, on television, etc. And my observation is that prayer is not one cause in the cause-effect nexus. That's not its function. Its function is something else. And it's got something to do with being overwhelmed by tragedy and asking God that somehow or other we become reattuned, so to speak. So I guess in partial answer to your question, I would ask, well, why do people pray in the first place? And, oh, yeah, some people want to change reality, but something else is going on in some cases. I do know that for myself, I use Jesus's prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane just before he's about to face his own death, and he ends that prayer with, not my will, but thy will be done. And even though this is a hard question you're asking, I just say, well, maybe that's the way I'm going to handle it. Not my will, but thy will be done. Amen. And take it from there.
Well, in a sense, you know, him begging to, or praying, or begging, I don't know, to have things work out differently for him, is both cathartic and healing.
You know, that's kind of what my Jesuit friend would say, and my charismatic friend would just revolts against it. It's not just a psychological trick to make us feel better. But there is a sort of contradiction in Jesus's prayer, because he opens by saying, let this cup pass from me. Well, that's an allusion to Socrates and the cup of poison that he was to drink in committing suicide. And Jesus is saying, I don't want to drink the cup of suicide, for crying out loud. And then he finishes with, not my will, but thy will be done. So there is a tension between the way he opens the prayer and the way he closes it. So is there a catharsis going on? Yes, there is. He's ending his prayer by accepting his destiny, which he was which he didn't want to do when he opened the prayer. Now, is that a model for every prayer? I don't think so. But is it only a catharsis?
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, and obviously it's a surrendering in any 12-step program or recovery program. It's like, okay, letting go of your own will, because damn it, your own will is not working, you know?
Right,
and time after time, I mean, people testified that when I've just let go of my own will and I've let whatever my higher power be sort of just guide me and get out of the way, as it were, then things start getting better. And it feels almost magical in that sense. And I think that's the point where you can argue, well, is it psychological or is it, supernatural? I personally, as far as my own personal recovery goes, I don't give a crap anymore because I just need to be a better person. So for me to sit there and bang my head up against the wall, whether it's psychological or whether it's supernatural, it doesn't matter to me as much as it used to, because banging my head up against the wall is what got me in trouble in the first place. So,
well, I like what you're saying. I like what you're saying a lot. And I think the observation that when we let go and let God, that's a trivial slogan, but it fits here, let go and let God, is that when we give up control, then we see a power that we wouldn't have otherwise been able to recognize. And it does do things. And at least in part, I think that's what prayer does. And the 12-step program is doing everything to coax us into allowing that healing power to have an effect on our lives. And magic, well, there's probably no better word for it than that. And one of the problems with the psychological explanation is that it's reductionistic, and it just seems like there's so much more than what can be reduced to psychology.
Sure, it's sort of saying, well, I have the answer, but you don't, not really. You know, it's sort of like saying, I'm like God. I know this is why things are, and until psychology has proven it out forthright, then I think that's a little arrogant to say. I kind of agree. Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, Ted, I just want to ask you: do you have anything coming up at all that you want to share?
Thank you for asking. We've mentioned my book, UFOs, God's Chariots, my book, Sin Boldly. Mm-hmm. And in a few months, I'll publish another book called God and Cosmic History, Science and History Meet Religion. And it's going to deal with big history, as is taught at our colleges and our universities, and trying to show where over time people have asked the question of God and what kind of answers they've experimented with. So that's coming up on Selm Press in another few months or so.
That's great to hear. You are busy, man. You're traveling, you're writing. Ted, thank you so much for coming on the show.
And out of trouble. Yeah, anyway, always good to talk with you, Alpha. I'm glad that you're feeling good about your spiritual life these days, and helping other people to pursue good health, spiritual health.
Thank you, Ted. Thanks, Ted. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a journey, to be sure. All right, so Ted's website is tedstimelytake.com. com. You can find all his previous books, new books, his media and teaching. Do you have a calendar for speaking events up there as well, Ted?
I do, and it appears there for upcoming and past, and sometimes there's a video or an audio that people can catch up on the history with.
All right, cool. Ted, thanks so much again for being on the show.
All right.
And for the rest of you out there, let the mystery take you. Be well.